The following program was funded by the Annenberg CPB Project.
Sound Studies in Psychology. This program is about research by Dr. Saul Sternberg on the way the mind processes information. Its title, Dr. Sternberg Talks About His Work.
I think of myself as someone who's curious about the way the mind works and who
Dr. Saul Sternberg is a calm man. I spoke with him for 6 hours, and occasionally he stroked his short beard, but he never fidgeted.
I think of myself as someone who's curious about the way the mind works and who uses whatever tools seem best to study human behavior in such a way as to find that out.
Dr. Sternberg looks younger than to have 20 years ago presented landmark research in the field of human information processing. He's a friendly, accommodating man. When I called him at Bell Labs at the last minute to say I would soon be in New York and needed to interview him, he graciously invited me to meet with him that Saturday morning at his home in Summit, New Jersey.
Town of Summit, New Jersey, one of the scenic wonders of New Jersey. It has a mixture of people. Many people work at Bell Laboratories because Bell Laboratories is only 3 miles away, at least one of the installations. There are also many bankers who work in New York, contribute a lot to the affluence of the community. We also have our slums and a cross-section of humanity.
The day I spoke to him, it was bright and sunny outdoors, but the inside of his house wasn't. He'd pulled down the window shades rather than air condition it. I put the tape recorder on a piano bench and the microphone on a music stand. We sat back in stuffed chairs and talked. At the center of Dr. Sternberg's work is a genuine wonder.
Almost any behavior that people engage in can be regarded in a way that makes it wonderful and mysterious.
From that center of wonder, Sternberg developed influential research on the processes of the mind. His concern with everyday operations of the mind has become a trend in his field.
One of the things that's happened in recent psychology is that people have started investigating some of the simple, everyday operations of the mind. And what we've discovered is that even these processes that seem effortless and automatic are interesting and complicated, and furthermore, that we have ways of studying them. We have ways of finding out about mental processes that are quite unobservable directly by doing the right kinds of experiments and analyzing data in certain ways. To many people, that's very exciting, that we can actually analyze everyday occurrences in new ways that give us new insights into something that before seemed rather ordinary and mundane. If you just contemplate some of these processes, they're just wonderful things. It may be that some mental operations don't appear particularly interesting just because they're very familiar and they seem to happen automatically. You have to look at things in a new way to realize how interesting they are. We're capable of doing many things remarkably well. I mean, we're capable of walking, for example. That's a remarkable thing to contemplate. Capable of carrying a cup of water from one place to another without spilling it, even though muscles all over our bodies are moving and so on. All these ordinary feats are quite remarkable. Once you start probing them and trying to understand how people accomplish them, you realize how little you know. And almost any additional knowledge is a lot of knowledge relative to what you know about some of these things.
Dr. Sternberg likes his work.
I mean, I really get excited by the things I do. I mean, I get up in the middle of the night and I work on things, or I'll spend the whole day at work developing an idea that I had that morning, or my colleagues and I will look into data for something that we never imagined was there, and we'll discover it, and we'll think of new ways of asking questions, and we'll go ahead and ask them. I mean, it's just extremely pleasurable and intellectually invigorating. In a way, well, it seems as if you're doing something that on the face of it is impossible. You know, how can you find out how the mind works? How could you discover the processes that are going on there? And in fact, psychologists are able to do that. And I don't think psychology is necessarily more exciting than other domains of science. I guess there's a sense in which it's different because you're finding out about something that you have. I mean, you have a mind and it works, and you're finding out something about it. And there's something nice about being a psychologist because often you can serve as a subject in your own experiments, and you can learn something informally that you also study objectively. And you can't do that in many other disciplines. You don't have to be a psychologist to realize how interesting and mysterious lots of our mental activities are. What is helpful when you're a psychologist is that you probably can do better at thinking of ways to answer the questions that occur to you. You probably can do better at asking questions that could conceivably be answered with the techniques that are available.
For over 100 years, scientists have attempted to measure the speed of human thought processes. But there's been more research on the topic since the mid-60s than in the entire preceding century. The turning point occurred when Dr. Sternberg published his work on the use of reaction time to study short-term memory. Although use of short-term memory appears to be automatic and instantaneous, for example, looking up a telephone number and then dialing it, Sternberg was able to make measurements on such a process. It's more accurately done in a laboratory, but that day at his home, Dr. Sternberg demonstrated with me his classic work.
The experiment is extremely simple. For the first trial,
he asked me to memorize a list of digits and then questioned me whether a particular test digit was in the list. The purpose of this experiment was to discover how people retrieve information they recently memorized.
Here's the set. 2, 9. Ready, set, 5.
No.
That was correct. 5 was not in the set 2, 9. Now we can try it again with a somewhat larger set of 5 items. The set is 3, 8, 9, 6, 4. Ready, set, 9. That also is right, because 9 was the third element that I gave you. Shall we try it once more? This time, again, a large set of items. 2, 6, 5, 9, 1. Ready?
Yeah.
Set, 4.
No.
Correct. As you were making these decisions on these trials of the experiment, did you have any ideas about how you were doing it? What was going through your head?
Not at all. I didn't have a thought.
So it seemed automatic to you?
Yeah.
You weren't aware of making any individual comparisons, right? Many subjects say that. If there's any process going on, any interesting process, they aren't aware of it. But other subjects say that they're searching. They are aware of some sort of search process. Well, what happens if you look at the average time it takes to respond, what we find is that the larger the set of items, the slower the response, the longer it takes. And there's quite good agreement across different people in how much this increase is. It increases by about a 25th of a second, or 40 milliseconds, 40 thousandths of a second, for each digit that you add to the set. So, for example, the first set I gave you had 2 digits in it, and the second one had 5. And generally speaking, the response time for the second set would be about a tenth of a second longer, about 3/25 of a second in particular longer. And the law that relates the average reaction time to the size of the set is a linear law, that is, you get the same increase when you change the size of the set from 1 item to 2 items as you get when you change the size of the set from 5 items to 6 items. That's one fact that seems to emerge from these experiments. And what that suggests is that, in fact, you don't have immediate access to the information in short-term memory. There's some process that takes time that's required in order for you to compare the test item to the items in memory, or to find the test item in the set. The other point of interest is that the rate at which this process proceeds is very fast. That is, if it's a simple search process where you're successively comparing the test item to each of the items in the set, then since, as I said, the time increases by about a 25th of a second for each item in memory, what that means is that you're searching at the rate of about 25 items in a second. That's a very high rate of search. For example, it's much faster than the rate at which you can talk to yourself. Now, there's another important, interesting feature of the data that you get from an experiment like this. Consider the way in which the time to respond increases. Consider that increase compared between the yes responses and the no responses. We can separately analyze the data for the no responses, the cases where the test item was not in the set, and the yes responses, that is, where it was in the set. Now, what we find...
What we find is probably not what we expect to find. We probably expect to look for an item until we see it, and then stop the search. So if we stopped when we found the item, we would expect that the time spent searching for a yes answer would be shorter than the time spent searching for a no answer. If the search was self-terminating, then an average of half the items would be searched if the answer was yes, but all items would be searched if the answer was no. Thus, if we added two items to a set, on the average, only one would be searched on yes trials, but both would be searched on no trials. So as we increase the size of the set, we would expect that reaction time for no trials would increase twice as fast as reaction time for yes trials. Consider a bookcase metaphor. If we look to see if a book is in a particular bookcase, we typically start the search at the top of the bookcase and stop when we see the book. This is an example of a self-terminating search.
Instead, the search process, if it is a search process, that seems to underlie this performance is an exhaustive search. It seems as if you search through the whole bookcase before you make your decision, even when the book is spotted early on. The subjects are being rewarded for being fast, so you'd think that they would stop as soon as they could, and yet they don't stop at the end of the search process. Well, when you find something that's as peculiar as that, given your common sense ideas, you try to understand it by developing models for it and then testing those models. And, of course, people have tried to do that, and I tried to do that shortly after I made this discovery, because I was very puzzled by the exhaustiveness of the search.
The puzzle is that people continue searching even after a matching digit has been discovered. A possible solution is that a search through the entire list may actually go at a faster rate than a search that has to stop partway through. This may be because subjects could postpone to the end the time-consuming process of checking for the presence of a match. They could make this check once and for all instead of doing it after each comparison. Dr. Sternberg wondered if that was true, then what would happen if the person had to check whether a match had occurred after each comparison? He devised a task that requires checking for a match after each item in the set is compared to the test item.
So we have to have an experiment in which the response depends on which item produced the match. Well, the kind of experiment we used is one where the subject was required not just to say whether or not a test item was in a set, but to give the name of the item that followed it in the set. Now, in order to produce the name of an item that follows the test item in the set, if you imagine the subject searching through the set to find that test item, the subject has to decide after each item whether or not a match had occurred, because that determines whether he should name the item that follows it.
Again, Sternberg asked me to memorize a short list of digits. But this time I was asked not whether an item appeared in a set, but to name the item that followed it.
So why don't we try that?
Okay.
I'll give you a set of five items, a list of five items, and then I'll say ready, set, and I'll give you one of the items, and you should name as quickly as you can the item that follows that item in the set. We'll use one of the sequences we used earlier. 3, 8, 9, 6, 5. Ready, set, 9.
6.
That's correct. But perhaps you noticed some differences between the process that you felt you were using to answer this question from the process that you were using earlier. Did you notice anything?
It seemed a little slower.
Your response was certainly slower.
I had to think of the answer and then, I had to think of the number and then remember that I was supposed to say the next number.
Were you aware of any search process? Were you aware of going one by one through the sequence?
Yeah, it didn't, before it seemed like one process, and this seemed like, I was going down the numbers and then had to think of the next number, so it seemed like a more complicated process.
I think that people tend to report more frequently that they have an experience of searching in this task than in the yes-no task. However, we don't rely on their introspective reports to determine what's happening in this experiment. We look at the reaction time data, and the main prediction that we have for this experiment, based on the theory about why the other process is exhausted, the main prediction is that the search process should be much slower, because there's a time-consuming, the hypothesis is that there would have to be a time-consuming process of checking for the presence of a match after each comparison here, whereas that would be delayed to the end of the whole sequence of operations in the other task. And in fact, we do indeed find two things. First of all, if we look at the reaction time as a function of the length of the list that the subject has memorized, if we look at the reaction time as a function of the length of that list, we find that it grows much more steeply, much more for each item in the list than it does if the subject just has to say yes or no. In fact, it grows at a rate that's about three times as great. The reaction time goes up about 120 milliseconds, or about a tenth of a second, instead of a 25th of a second for each item in the list. Furthermore, if we look in detail at the data, we find that unlike the other search process, this search process is self-terminating. That is, the subject does seem to stop when he or she finds the test item in the list. And those are the two things that we expect from our theory. So what happens is that this task confirms the theory about why the other process is exhausted.
In the years following the publication of Sternberg's work, suggesting the normal search process is exhaustive, there has been a tremendous amount of follow-up research. Hundreds of papers have been written on the topic. The issues raised by his research have been widely debated, criticized, and alternative models have been presented to the psychological community. I ask him why he thought this happened.
It's clear that it's captured the imagination of lots of people. Okay, why is it? Well, it seems to me that, of course, I don't know why it is that a particular kind of experiment and a particular analysis and a result and so on, I don't really know why it is that it excites people. But I can imagine a number of reasons why this might have. First of all, the question that's being asked is in a way a very simple question. We think we know the answer before we start. We think we know that, let's say, five or six items are simultaneously available to consciousness. So if you ask, how do you gain access to them, that is a non-question. So one is asking a question where before there didn't seem to be a question. So that's one interesting thing, that you can raise new questions that haven't been around. And in fact, then we get an answer that's unexpected. We don't expect that it's going to take more time when you change the number of items that you have to deal with from 2 to 3. We start out thinking that we should be able to access them all at the same time and ask the question immediately, as the introspective reports suggest. So There's a new question where there didn't seem to be a question before. There's a way of answering it, and there's a surprising answer. As the answer unfolds, it continues to be surprising. It suggests a search process, but the search process goes on at rates that are much faster than the rate at which you can talk to yourself. Well, before this proposal, psychologists hadn't considered the possibility that there might be internal search processes that were sequential and that proceeded at such high rates. Another aspect that might have excited people's imaginations or might have made them interested in this kind of experiment is that the data are very orderly. That is, if you look at data from this kind of experiment, you get beautifully structured data. The data are you get a linearly increasing mean reaction time. That is, the data fall on a straight line pretty well. And so it's a case where, despite the enormous degree to which extraneous variables, variables that are very hard to control, influence human performance, and that, of course, creates great difficulties for psychology, the individual differences between people, the fact that people change over time, makes for great difficulties in psychology. Despite all that, one can, it turns out, devise experimental procedures that give very orderly data. And, of course, there are many other instances of that in psychology, but it seems to me that any clear instance tends to make people sit up and pay attention, take notice. I think another reason that attracted attention is that it exemplified making inferences from data on how people behaved to a process that was not directly observable. Now, of course, again, there are many instances of that in psychology, and that's one of the exciting things about psychology in general. But this was an instance of just that. And it was a very simple process, and a process that could be described fairly well. And furthermore, there were, at the time, a lot of experiments that went along with the basic experiment that really suggested that other alternative possible mechanisms weren't operating, that in fact tended to fairly strongly support the search theory. Now, since then, of course, it has become obvious that one can develop alternative accounts that explain the data. And it's a matter of controversy what actually underlies data like this. But the original proposal still is a contender. It may turn out in the end that it is a very rapid internal search process.
My whole body, especially my brain, was fatigued after sitting and talking with Dr. Sternberg for so many hours. Late in the afternoon, I ended the interview and asked him how he felt.
I feel slightly tired, but I could probably go on. I should look at a bus schedule for you.
Dr. Saul Sternberg is a psychologist who studies human information processing at AT&T Bell Laboratories.
Dr. Sternberg Talks About His Work was written and produced by Vicki Lofquist, with technical production by Kevin Medea. Chief Academic Advisor for Sound Studies in Psychology is Emeritus Professor of Psychology John G. Darley of the University of Minnesota. Sound Studies in Psychology is a production of KUOM Radio at the University of Minnesota.
Sound Studies, a project of the Committee on Institutional Cooperation. The programs are funded by the Annenberg CPB Project, providing opportunities for higher education through telecommunications.